Blog Talk Radio.
Well, Donald Trump looked directly at the sun, and then he gave an Afghanistan speech that promised to create a surge. And so we are moving beyond the racial argument, at least for a few hours, leaving Russia in the rearview mirror, of course. So we've got Trump promising to fix Afghanistan, a place he said earlier before when he was running for office that we should just leave. And, you know, I'm looking for clips of this. This is kind of strange. because I just see either commentary or I see the full speech, which was somewhere around 30 minutes. But I have a ton of stories for you today, so many stories. And it is still Death Row Radio, but we have another week. We've got some clemency here. Or as Kathy pointed out, I miscalculated. So it's going to be the last day of the month that is the last day of the show. And the last day of the month is also the last day of the format, talk radio format. And I was trying to figure out how many talk radio shows there were in this part of the world. I didn't think that there was anything between here. I looked up Amarillo and they have one. But then I went back and looked at Roswell, and they have a morning show, but live radio was something like 500 by 500 miles or 500 by 700 by 500, I think would be appropriate between Albuquerque and Austin. I don't think there's any talk radio, no talk radio in El Paso, no live morning show. So we're talking an area of like 500,000 miles, square miles, which I was kind of astounded by. But, you know, the more conservative an area is, the more likely it is to have talk radio. So I guess that explains why talk radio is leaving this area. But, you know, Adams Radio could pick up the format. All right, let's get into a little bit. The world didn't end. There was no, well, at least as far as we know, there was no apocalypse. If you buy into Jehovah Witness theology, they talk about, they predicted the end of the world, Jesus coming back and everything. And when it didn't obviously happen, they came up with the doctrine of the secret return. But here is a little bit on... Well, you know what? I want to let me just give the beginning of the speech, since there's no clips of it. You can hear how Trump started off his speech on Afghanistan. Yeah, here we go.
Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Tillerson, members of the cabinet, General Dunford, Deputy Secretary Shanahan, and Colonel Duggan. Most especially, thank you to the men and women of Fort Myer and every member of the United States military at home and abroad. We send our thoughts and prayers to the families of our brave sailors who were injured and lost after a tragic collision at sea, as well as to those conducting the search and recovery efforts. I am here tonight to lay out our path forward in Afghanistan and South Asia. But before I provide the details of our new strategy, I want to say a few words to the service members here with us tonight, to those watching from their posts, and to all Americans listening at home. Since the founding of our republic, our country has produced a special class of heroes whose selflessness, courage, and resolve is unmatched in human history. American patriots from every generation have given their last breath on the battlefield for our nation and for our freedom. Through their lives, and though their lives were cut short, in their deeds they achieved total immortality. By following the heroic example of those who fought to preserve our republic, we can find the inspiration our country needs to unify, to heal, and to remain one nation under God. The men and women of our military operate as one team, with one shared mission and one shared sense of purpose. They transcend every line of race, ethnicity, creed, and color to serve together and sacrifice together in absolutely perfect cohesion. That is because all service members are brothers and sisters. They are all part of the same family. It's called the American family. They take the same oath, fight for the same flag, and live according to the same law. They are bound together by common purpose, mutual trust, and selfless devotion to our nation and to each other. The soldier understands what we as a nation too often forget, that a wound inflicted upon a single member of our community is a wound inflicted upon us all. When one part of America hurts, we all hurt. And when one citizen suffers an injustice, we all suffer together. Loyalty to our nation demands loyalty to one another. Love for America requires love for all of its people. When we open our hearts to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice, no place for bigotry, and no tolerance for hate. The young men and women we send to fight our wars abroad deserve to return to a country that is not at war with itself at home. We cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we are not at peace with each other.
All right, that's the beginning. Let's get a little commentary. There's another 15 minutes of it. And to send more troops to Afghanistan.
Sending thousands more troops to Afghanistan. That was one
from
of
Fox's
plans that was unveiled last night in his first primetime address since he took office.
Let's go to Blake Berman, who has details from the White House.
The commander-in-chief announcing a new strategy in Afghanistan. The president did not say how many more troops will be headed to Afghanistan, but a senior U.S. official told Fox 4,000 more have been authorized to head into that country. Currently, 8,400 troops are on the ground in Afghanistan. Part of the new strategy, President Trump said, is to try to get Pakistan to rid itself of safe havens.
We have been paying Pakistan billions and billions of dollars. At the same time, they are housing the very terrorists that we are fighting. But that will have to change, and that will change immediately.
In his pre-political days, the president had vouched for a 180. He called for the U.S. to withdraw from Afghanistan. He explained his new thinking is a function of his new job.
My original instinct was to pull out. And historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office.
The president also began his speech with a nod to his controversial comments on Charlottesville. President Trump saying, quote, "We cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we're not at peace with each other." Back to you in New York.
Well, and the president is getting support from an unlikely ally, Senator John McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying in a statement, quote, "I commend President Trump for taking a big step in the right direction with the new strategy for Afghanistan." Senator Lindsey Graham also welcoming the president's decision.
All right, so here's a, well, let's take a break and come back and hear from a special forces person as to Trump's idea. You're listening to AM Las Cruces 523 1450 on AM 1450 with Kelly O'Connell. And 805-618-8050-6180 is your text line. Got a little Hank Williams here, Cold Cold Heart. Live renditions of Hank. Hank was about 6 feet tall and 120 pounds. Not in great health when he died. Died in the back of a Lincoln Continental, of a drug and alcohol overdose before he was 30. What a way to go. Be right back.
Thank you, Roy. I've got a song here that I'd like to do that's been awful kind to me and the boys. It's bought us quite a few beans and biscuits. This is the best song we've ever had, financially. A little tune called Cold, Cold Heart. I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do. It's just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Hey, it's Kelly.
Hey, Kelly. So I didn't listen to his speech on television, but you played a little of it here. You know what it proves to me?
What?
It proves that he's got a speechwriter, and if he's really pressured, he can stay on script and read. But I know what's in his heart. He tweets about it. He goes off script about it when he gets out there and starts answering. When that man speaks from his heart, he doesn't have one. So, I mean, I know he's your idol.
He's not my idol. Hey, wait a second. I have never said I idolize the guy. I've never talked about him like I idolize him. What do you?
That's true. So I take that back. You're right.
Jeez.
You don't idolize him. You tolerate him because he's a Republican.
I tolerate him because I want to see something happen in the country.
Yeah, but it's amazing what you're willing to give up. Everything that we were taught to believe in from our heart, you're willing to give up because he's lowering our taxes and he's going to bring back jobs that we could have had if Obama would have been cooperated with. He would have done the jobs bill, but no, you know, all they wanted to do was block Obama, and you criticize people for blocking Trump, and he is.
Kathy. Hold on a second. I'm not asking you to go on the air. I'm asking you to listen for a second. Obama had a Democratic Senate and House for 2 years. There was nothing to stop him. What are you talking about?
2 years? Yeah, he had it for 2 years. And for six, they did nothing but block him.
Oh, so come
on. He must have misused the supermajority because he was slammed. Replacements in the Republican Party taken over from the Democrats, and he didn't get anything accomplished, basically, for the next 6 years. So
he didn't get anything accomplished, period.
Yeah, he got us out of two wars that Trump.
We're still in the war.
He got us out of two wars.
How did he get us out of Afghanistan?
He withdrew 150,000 troops.
We're still in the war.
Yeah, and even more so, thanks to Donald Trump, he's going to build it back up after spending the whole time railing against Obama that we were even over there, and now Trump is putting people back when Obama took them out.
If it wasn't for Obama taking the people out of, there wouldn't be no ISIS. Hey, I got to go back on the air. Do you want to say something?
No, but thanks for listening.
Bye. All right, thank you. Did you know that the Republicans kept Obama from doing anything good? That's what I was just informed by a caller who didn't want to go on the air and talk about it. And Trump can read his speech, but he has no heart. Obama got us out of two wars. Is Afghanistan a war? I think Afghanistan is a war. Was Afghanistan a war that Obama said he'd shut down and had 8 years to do so? Did he shut it down? All right. So, but now he didn't. It's still going on. But beyond this, think about this. The one that he did shut down was Iraq. And he did know, you know, Obama did know status of forces. I don't know if that's the right phrase of art, but it's something like that. Let me Google it here, but he didn't have any setup. He was so anxious to get out of there, and I think Obama is a passive aggressive person. He likes to see bad things happen and blame it on somebody else, you know? And so, I mean, obviously a very conflicted guy. And here it is, PolitiFact. Obama refused to sign plan in place to leave 10,000 troops in Iraq. Even his own party. Status of forces agreement. He refused to sign one because I believe that in Obama's mind, he was blaming everything on Trump because that's what he did. That was his go-to move because he didn't know what he was doing. Uncharitable, maybe. True, undoubtedly. Obama leaves this vacuum in Russia's ISIS. Did Obama create ISIS? Well, no, he didn't go over there and fundraise for him and organize him, but he put the perfect opportunity for them to come together and then said, we're going to take 10 years to take them out. It'll take 10 years. I mean, what baffles me is the idea that Donald Trump could be worse than Obama. That's the thing that I find shocking to hear. All right, here's former Special Forces officer on Trump's Afghanistan plan.
Perspective now from a former Special Forces officer who served multiple tours in Afghanistan, retired Green Beret Michael Waltz, who was also a senior counterterrorism advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, and he's the author of the book Warrior Diplomat, A Green Beret's Battles from Washington to Afghanistan. He joins us tonight from Jacksonville, Florida. Mike, thanks for being here. I want to bring you up today. We just got some new information from our Pentagon team. Fox News can confirm at this hour, senior U.S. official say the president is signing off on an additional 4,000 troops to Afghanistan. But a big part of the speech tonight, we're being told, he'll include asking the region to do more, asking India and Pakistan to do more to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. When you hear that, read between the lines.
Well, Brett, if you know this is the case, then I'm proud of our president tonight. This takes leadership. Afghanistan's incredibly difficult. It's a regional problem. And I think what you're going to see in this announcement let me just go into a second what you're not going to see. You're not going to see our troops doing nation building. You're not going to see hundreds of thousands of troops in direct combat. You're going to see our soldiers advising and assisting the Afghan army in building their capability to fight on their own. And that's going to take some time. You're also not going to see a bunch of arbitrary timelines. You know, I was in my headquarters in Afghanistan when President Obama announced the surge, but then announced when it was leaving. And I think you are going to see some tougher demands of the Afghan government, particularly when it comes to corruption. And you're going to see us get a lot tougher on Pakistan and its support, or at least turning a blind eye to the Taliban, ISIS, and other groups, and Al-Qaeda as well, that are staging attacks into Afghanistan from Pakistani soil. And finally, I think you're going to see us move closer to India, the world's largest democracy, who is also really serving as a hedge against both China and against Pakistan. You know, we're going to see some strategy shift here, but at the end of the day, we could not withdraw. We could not just do what we did in Iraq and let the Islamic State move into Afghanistan and still attack Europe and still attack the United States.
From this reporting, in addition, adding to what you just said, the president will announce he will hold Pakistan accountable for attacks in its country and continuing to support the Taliban, and also ask what's different, officials saying the pace, scope, and overall pressure campaign will be different than it has before. You buy that?
I do. One of General McMaster's key lieutenants is a woman by the name of Lisa Curtis. She has written for years about how to dial up pressure on the Pakistani government. You know, they've essentially been playing a double game in many ways. part of that was because they were convinced that the United States was just going to leave and they were going to be holding the bag. So I think part of the messaging here is this is in our national interest. We're not going to let the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda move in the wake of the Taliban. We are going to eventually negotiate, but it's going to be from a position of strength. So Pakistan region, you need to get on board with where we're going here. We are not going to just turn our back and walk away.
And we should point out Iran is now active inside Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, they are. I mean, Iran is playing a much bigger game here, and Afghanistan's just a piece of it in terms of reinserting itself across the Middle East from Western Afghanistan through Iraq, through Syria, into Lebanon and to the Mediterranean. They're creating that Shia crescent. And if they can tap into anyone in Afghanistan, whether it's their Shia allies and ethnic minorities or the Taliban, who they have historically opposed, but they'll you know, cut deals and have marriages of convenience for bigger Iranian names. So all of these reasons, Russia, China, Pakistan, Iran, are reasons that we just can't turn our back on the region. And I am absolutely convinced, I just can't say it enough, that ISIS will establish itself. It's already trying in Afghanistan if we just walk away. And I'm thrilled to hear the president's moved away from that option.
Just one last thing. I want to put up this,
sure,
this board, Afghanistan by the numbers. You spent a lot of time on the ground there as a commander.
I have. Yeah.
8,400 U.S. troops currently in Afghanistan, $714 billion spent. 2,258 total deaths, 20,257 total wounded. More than 11% of Afghanistan still today is controlled by insurgents or the Taliban.
That's right.
For people who say, gosh, this effort has been so long, there is that feeling inside the country.
Oh, sure. Believe me, Brett, I'm frustrated. There's a lot of frustrations and there's a lot of things that we could have done better and should do better. But at the end of the day, do we want to fight them in Kandahar and Kabul, or do we want to fight them in Kansas City? And that's a critical decision that we have to make. And I think this is going to look, you know, a lot like things have looked in Colombia, where we've had soldiers for 25 years helping the Colombian army fight the FARC guerrillas and keep that from becoming a narco state. We've had 30,000 soldiers in Korea for almost 70 years. You know, this is going to be a long-term effort, unfortunately. And in terms of troop numbers, you know, we've had about 15,000 except for that surge period. And I think we're going to see that, you know, into the foreseeable future.
Former Green Beret, Mike Waltz, with his expertise. Mike, thanks.
All right. Hey, thanks, Brett.
All right. We got local news for you right here. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 and 805-6180-2 text.
Another love before my time, made your heart sad. And so my heart is paying now for things I didn't.
So our solar eclipse is proof of God. This is Eric Metaxas. He's a Christian writer, and he says, in reference to yesterday's eclipse, that he sat down and figured out what it would take to, I'm going to read that. I got to reread that to make sure that I understand it. All right. Who was responsible for the violence in Charlottesville? There's an interesting article that comes out in the LA Times in which both sides had stake in this thing, and I gotta figure out where this music is coming from. Hold on, there we go. You know, sometimes these windows pop up out of the blue. They're like a gopher coming out of the lawn. But let me get you to. It's too long of an article to read, but basically what I'll just sum it up for you because it was a pretty good article. The white people or the neo-Nazis or the white supremacists, whatever, showed up to go to the park where the statue was supposed to be taken down or where they were talking about taking it down. It's called Lee's Park. And according to some reports, they had to kind of run the gauntlet past these Antifa people. I prefer Antifa to Antifa because it makes it sound like an island. Where are you from? I'm from Antifa. And Antifa, you know, anti-fascist. So it talked about that the Antifa was throwing stuff and yelling things, and the supremacists did fight back. I think the supremacists were trying to get to Lee's Park, and basically the Antifa were trying to block them, or were kind of blocking them. And but there were skirmishes in the street. There were fights back and forth. But one of the most notable things is that the police were not involved, and so if it wasn't for the non-involvement of the police, I don't think all of this other stuff would have likely happened. I mean, we'll never know, but there was back and forth, and there were some neo-Nazis getting beaten up. But according to the reports, it was very clear that it was on both sides, that there was, you know, like Trump said, there was blame to go around on both sides. Now, I want to get a clip. All right, and this is from Jake Tapper from CNN on Antifa, the violent legacy of Antifa.
By most accounts, almost all of the people protesting against the hateful bigots, the Nazis and Klansmen in Charlottesville, were peaceful, but not all of them. In their midst was a sometimes very violent group of protesters that call themselves Antifa, known to not only clash with bigots, but also sometimes with police and occasionally storefronts. At least two journalists in Virginia were assaulted by violent counter-protesters over the weekend, including this cameraman from the Richmond CBS affiliate. CNN's Sarah Gannon now takes us inside Antifa and shows us this group like you've never seen it before.
It's 6 a.m. in Portland, Oregon, and we're headed to a bar with blacked-out windows.
They wanted to meet us really early in the morning because they're concerned about a lot of people being around.
We are meeting members of the Rose City Antifa, short for anti-fascist. This group's main goal is to disrupt neo-Nazis and white supremacists, but also take on government and capitalism.
Antifa is any group.
So the protest movements that occurred a couple of years ago, trying to remember the name of it, the anti-Wall Street group, these would be the same people.
That's willing to stand up against fascists by any means necessary.
By any means necessary, they say, can mean outing a white nationalist at their work or to their neighbors. Or, as we've seen recently, violence, fires, property damage, hand-to-hand combat at protests across the country.
Explain to me the reasoning behind fighting. You have to make it so unpalatable to be doing white supremacist organizing that they no longer want to do that. And historically, that's what's worked. You have to put your body in the way, and you have to make it speak in a language that they understand, and sometimes that is violent.
There's no firm number on how many Antifa activists there are in the U.S. because there isn't any one organization. Most are local groups that recruit and communicate through social media. But experts who track these organizations say their membership is growing in response to the rise of white national groups and the election of President Donald Trump. Violence and property destruction led to more than 200 arrests in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day. Prosecutors say they were wearing masks covered head to toe in black, a tactic the Antifa call black bloc.
People dress in black bloc for a few things. One,
Scott Crow has been leading anarchist and militant leftist groups for decades.
So people put on the masks so that we can all become anonymous. And then therefore we are able to move more freely and do what we need to do, whether it is illegal or not.
So some people will push back on that and say that the black bloc is to keep people from being identified and arrested when they break the law, when they commit crimes.
Damn right. It's a good way to avoid the ramifications of law enforcement.
We saw that firsthand at a May Day protest in New York City.
We cover our face because the Nazis will try to find out who we are. And that is a very bad thing because they harass people. When they organize, they kill people, they hurt people, they fight people. And we're the ones who are fighting back. They are the second coming of Hitler.
Police in Berkeley told us they haven't seen this kind of destruction since the 1960s. Law enforcement in other cities are dealing with similar situations, like in Portland, Oregon, where Antifa have been involved in at least 10 protests ending in violence, according to police. And it's wearing on the community.
It is new. It's like this rumble mentality of, I'm going to bring my friends, you bring your friends, and we're going to fight it out in the park. It's not something we've seen here. It's not good for the city. People are just frustrated by it. It's affecting their livability. It's affecting their business.
Has it become more violent?
It happens quicker. The fire starting that we saw on May Day is something we haven't really seen much of in the past. The running through the street, breaking windows and everything in sight. We haven't seen it as consistently as we've seen it in the last 8 months.
But it's the violence that's gotten them attention, directly confronting groups that preach white nationalist rhetoric, like on Inauguration Day when white nationalist Richard Spencer was punched in the face. And it was the Antifa movement that caused Berkeley to cancel speeches by extreme right provocateurs like Milo Yiannopoulos.
If there are the more hardcore elements, the white supremacists and neo-Nazis that go to these rallies that are itching for a fight, we're there to say, we'll stand in your way.
The thing is, Jake, that experts who I've talked to say that the Antifa violence may end up actually hurting their cause. Across the country, people who are dressing in black bloc are getting arrested. Authorities are taking this seriously, but that's not stopping them at all. They have been telling me that they believe that this tactic is working. Now, one of the interesting things that I found in doing this reporting, what's really surprised me, is that we found that a lot of these new Antifa members, they're young people, disenfranchised young people who felt that they were let down by both parties after the election, and this is where they ended up. Jake?
All right, so I thought you might find that notable, and then I've got a little bit of a follow-up between... I've got a couple clips here. I got to remember which ones. One of the reports was that the Civil Rights Commission that looked into Charlottesville would only condemn the neo-Nazi violence.
Was quick to condemn last week's violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, as they should have, of course, but the commission statement only condemned the violence of one side, the white supremacists. The commission deliberately voted down a proposal, a statement that would have condemned violence from the other side, the left, Antifa. Why'd they do that? Peter Kirstenhaus serves on that commission, and he joins us tonight. Peter Kirstenhaus, thanks a lot for coming on. So,
thanks for having me.
Why would the commission, if I'm understanding this correctly, this wasn't just a faultless omission. This was an intentional decision not to condemn that violence. Why would they make that decision?
I think it's because they approve of a certain set of political positions and disapprove of others. And if you are perpetrating violence in furtherance of something they approve of, well, maybe they'll look the other way. They refused to adopt a very reasonable amendment to the resolution that all of us voted on, condemning the violence in Charlottesville. But the resolution was directed only at the Klan, the white nationalists, the Nazis, very appropriately so. That should have been condemned, and we all voted in condemnation. We also made note of the tragic death of Heather Heyer. But there was copious amount of reporting that shows that Antifa was also engaged in brutality. The New York Times reported it. A couple of media people were beat over the head by Antifa folks. They were using clubs. They were beating people. And so we made a very reasonable proposal, an anodyne proposal, if you will, that said, while we support peaceful protest, there was violent protest, and we condemn violence by all sides, including the so-called Antifa group. But the majority on the commission, 6-2, voted against it.
Do they? I mean, that seems like such a reasonable proposal. Do they explain why they didn't vote for it?
The only explanations we got were they didn't want to water down the original proposal. And one of the commissioners said, well, we don't want to necessarily condemn people who may have gotten carried away. That's an unsatisfactory response from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Our organic statute says that we deal with denials of equal protection. We're about equal treatment. And yet, if you have a disfavored viewpoint, and look, I have a disfavored viewpoint of the Klan, white nationalists, and all of those folks, but that doesn't give license to another group to beat you with impunity. By the same token, if you're going to condemn the Klan for engaging in violent behavior, should engage. You should condemn other groups also for engaging the same type of violent behavior.
So here's the question. Are the white nationalists wrong because they're anti-black and anti-Jewish and anti-whatever else? Or are they wrong because they're violent and they're hateful? Because if that's why they're wrong, then Antifa would seem to fall under the same judgment. We'll be right back. 6:48, Kelly O'Connell. I got one more clip from this.
Anger, unkind words or sin that make the teardrop start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold?
All right, I got a clip here. Forget Antifa. Here's a clip from Norm Macdonald with Jay Leno. A cat story.
But how you doing? Everything okay at your house? Everything good?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm having a little trouble. I have a cat, you know?
You have a cat? I know you're a
sure.
big cat lover. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't love them, but I have one.
Yeah. I don't understand that.
I keep it at a platonic level.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But, I have a cat. My friend Steve Corn, you know, who's a great man.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. He was living in New York City when I was living there, and he was my buddy. And then he left. He went to L.A. You know, Los Angeles. How would you not know that?
Yeah.
And he's working on the Seinfeld show now. So he goes, "Hey Norm, I'll give you my cat free." You know, so I'm always looking for a good deal. You know.
Yeah, free.
A free cat. So I get this cat. So then, like, a couple weeks later, he has a heart attack.
The cat?
Yeah. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
No, but...
I know. Who would know a cat could even have a heart attack? It's crazy.
So, what happened?
I came home, and I go, okay. And I walk through my door, you know, into my apartment, right. And there's the cat, and he's got, like, foam coming out of his mouth, and he's going, like... and there's foam and everything, and he's, like, crazy. You know, he's acting like a crazy cat.
Right.
And so, like, I'm scared. I don't want to go near him because I can tell, like, he's delirious and maybe, I don't know.
Really?
You don't know.
Anything could happen.
Yeah, he could think I was a mouse or something, you know, or bite me. So I go, I got to do something, man. My cat, something's wrong with him, you know. He's not supposed to be doing this. So quickly, I think quick, you know.
Yeah.
I grab the phone. I phone 911, you know. And it turns out they don't want to hear about a cat.
No, that's
only for people, you know. They said that to me. They go, "This is for people." So I said, all right. I don't know what to do. What's the cat number? They go, "Just get off the phone." You know, they got to keep the lines free. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to do. So my neighbor, you know, Bill.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter what his name is, but his name is Bill. So I knock on his door, Bill, he's not home. Some other guy's there, you know, I don't know what the hell is going on there. But the other guy comes, I don't ask questions, you know?
Let's get involved.
So I say, listen, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you're doing at Bill's place, but my cat is in deep trouble. You know, he's going, and he's got stuff coming out. So the guy goes, we got to get him to a hospital, you know? So I go, look, I just phoned 911. I'm sure they don't want to see a cat at a hospital either. He goes, no, there's animal hospitals, you know? So he took me to this, it's a place called an animal hospital. I swear to God, they actually have these. You can bring your cat there. Do you have a cat?
Yeah, I know an animal hospital. I have them all over the place. Quite common, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I ring my cat and I go, doc, there's a doc there. You know, they have doctors.
For cats.
They have cat doctors. So I go, listen, doc, my cat, something. So they take him away, you know, and I'm sitting like in they have a waiting room. It's exactly like a real place, except it's ridiculous, you know? So everyone's sitting around, they're worried, you know, oh, I hope my dog is all right, you know? So the guy brings me in the office and he goes, listen, he goes, you know, your cat is at a heart attack. So I go, come on, my cat didn't have a heart attack. And he goes, no, seriously. And I go, well, how can a cat have a heart attack? He goes, oh, many different things. He goes, diet, stress, you know. Like, how the hell could a cat have stress? You know what? That's not true. The guy's just making up stuff, you know.
You think he's making up stuff?
Well, no. My cat has a big promotion coming up. He's got all worried, you know.
You're worried about it.
So I said to the guy, okay. I go, fair enough. I'll go along with it. He goes, I'll let you visit with your cat. They have a visiting time. This is the oddest part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
They take you in a room, and then they bring your cat in, and he's all drugged up. They got him drugged. And they put him on like a gurney, and he's like standing there like this. And then the guy says, okay. He says, you only have 30 minutes to talk to your cat. So he leaves. You're in a room with a cat for like 30 minutes. Like crazy. Then after like 5 minutes, you go, I got a life to get back to. You know? I can't talk to your cat.
All right, so we'll take a break on the break on the hour and be back. 523-1450-805-6180. Kelly O'Connell, Death Row Radio. We got one last week. Let's live it up. Good morning. If you're just tuning in, 7:06, it is the 22nd of August, and I've got some headlines for you. President unveils his Afghanistan terror plan. He's also criticizing other areas around there. Pakistan has always had kind of a mixed record in terms of being on the side of the West and anti-terror and everything. There's a lot of radicals that live there. And if I'm not mistaken, bin Laden was living there when he was killed, wasn't he? So obviously that's a difficult country to have a relationship with. Phoenix is bracing for Trump's arrival in its massive protest. Scientists remotely hacking brain and controlling body movements. 42 hurt after trains collide near Philly. Blood is everywhere. We had our event with the sun and the moon. And the nation was awed. Many people felt let down. Traffic nightmares. Selfies causing major congestion. and the animals going haywire as it turns dark in the middle of the day. And Duterte faces nationwide revolt in the Philippines over his drug war, total lack of due process, and just going out and apparently randomly killing people they think are drug dealers and drug users. North Korea is still threatening the United States and Australia. Claims they will never give up their nuclear arms. Man arrested for hiding 5.7 million pills in sheep intestines. That's very creative. And looking for anything else you can't live without here. A woman was cut in half almost immediately after giving birth when the stretcher she was on was caught in an elevator. Chances for tax cuts are apparently going up, although it's not really clear why. I have to read that article for you. Now, what about the collision of these ships, the second one in 2 months, that I thought you would find notable? And they ask this, the head of the fleet is looking into this collision. It's very worrisome because they really don't know why suddenly out of the blue there's all of these collisions. Now, I've got a little clip that will explain to you the take on this, but here's a little background on this.
Right now in the waters off Malaysia and Singapore for sailors missing from yet another collision between a U.S. Navy warship and a civilian vessel. Now, the Navy has expanded its investigation. National Security Correspondent Jennifer Griffin has the latest tonight from the Pentagon.
It's the second major collision involving a U.S. Navy warship in the past 2 months in the Pacific. The latest collision involved the USS John S. McCain, a guided missile destroyer, which collided with a Liberian-flagged oil tanker three times its size near the busy Strait of Malacca. The warship was able to limp into port and is now in Singapore. 10 sailors remain missing. Operations to search the flooded berthing compartments began at first light. 4 injured sailors were airlifted off the ship. The Navy's top officer has called for a broader investigation.
I would direct an operational pause be taken in all of our fleets around the world.
While traveling in Jordan, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said he fully supported Admiral John Richardson's efforts.
He has put together a broader inquiry to look into these incidents and to determine any of the causal factors.
This is the 4th major mishap for the U.S. Navy in the Pacific since late January. A guided missile cruiser ran aground in Tokyo Bay, spilling more than 1,000 gallons of oil. In May, another cruiser collided with a fishing boat. In June, the USS Fitzgerald hit a cargo ship, killing 7 Navy sailors. 2 ship captains have already been relieved for these prior mishaps. President Trump responded to news of the crash as he returned to the White House from vacation. He later tweeted, "Thoughts and prayers are with our U.S. Navy sailors aboard the USS John S. McCain, where search and rescue efforts are underway."
Here is a little bit from an investigation that is starting with, and this is off of PBS, repeated Navy collisions suggest a systemic problem, and the gentleman who is being interviewed here is the top investigator for this stuff, I think.
Has ordered a one-day worldwide safety review after a destroyer collided with a civilian oil tanker ship east of Singapore. 10 U.S. sailors are missing and 5 are injured. Just 2 months ago, there was another deadly collision between a destroyer and a cargo ship near Japan. These are the latest in a series of incidents involving Navy ships in the Pacific. Is there a systemic problem? John Yang has more.
Thanks, Judy. To examine that question, we're joined by retired Navy officer Brian McGrath, who commanded a destroyer identical to the ones involved in the two latest collisions. He's now a consultant to the Navy. Mr. McGrath, thanks for joining us. We've had four incidents in the Pacific with Navy ships. The last two collisions, the Fitzgerald off the coast of Japan, the McCain now off the coast of Singapore. A run of bad luck, or is there something more elemental wrong here?
You can't hang your hat on a run of bad luck. It's unsatisfying and probably not the right answer. The right answer is to look hard at what ties these incidents together, all four of them potentially, and learn from that. So it's reaching conclusions is wrong right now. Forming hypotheses is right.
But what could be the problem? If there is a systemic problem, what do you think the roots could be?
The roots go back to the end of the Cold War. The roots go back to America becoming the predominant sea power on the face of the earth and losing an opponent that focused its efforts. And over the course of time, the Navy became less important to the country, and we progressively funded it less. We had less of a Navy, less of the size of the Navy, and we funded it inconsistently over the course of the last 12 or 13 years.
So how would that lack of funding translate into these kinds of accidents?
It translates by having too few ships to do what's required in that theater. And because there are too few ships and the work has to be done, my theory is that they sometimes have to cut corners on the basic training. And I think the CNO today, who announced a panel to look into this, I think that's one of the things they'll look into, whether or not they're getting the basic training time they need.
CNO, Chief of Naval Operations. So in this operational pause, what's going to happen?
The first thing is, if a ship is involved in a sensitive operational mission, it won't pause. It will continue to do its operations. But by and large, throughout the fleet, both at sea and ashore, ships will take a full day. They will get their bridge teams, their combat information center teams, their engineering teams together, their navigation detail. And they will go through the procedures. They will go through the common reports. They'll go through the things that they have to do every time, right the first time, and create a sense of importance, create a sense that business as usual is not acceptable. We have to get back on the right side of safety here.
You commanded a destroyer, the Bulkley, for how long?
2 years.
Did you have any close calls?
Anyone who has gone to sea for an extended period of time has had close calls. How close they are is a factor of just how well you and the other ship involved are following the rules of the road. If both ships follow the rules of the road, they're not going to collide.
Brian McGrath, thanks for joining us to talk about this.
My pleasure.
All right, and I thought that was kind of an interesting take on all this, that maybe there's a reason for this, and it's pretty basic, which is that we are not as trained and as ready as we used to be, which is a little bit scary, you know, given the amount of unrest in the world. We'll take a break here, 716-523-1450, 805-6180. Kelly O'Connell on AM Las Cruces.
Take over, Hank.
That's a pretty song to start with this morning. Awful pretty. Blue eyes crying in the rain.
In the twilight glow, I see her. Blue eyes crying in the rain.
Hey, it's Kelly.
As we
hold on,
kiss
let me,
goodbye
let me,
and parted.
Hold on, hold on.
I knew we'd never meet again.
Somehow someone is hacking in and sending wrong information, or, you know, trying to purposely see these Navy vessels who are out there, you know, in a part of the world that maybe the Chinese don't want them to be, hacking into the controls, into the guidance systems of the ships, something like that.
Possible. I don't know that much about it.
I don't either. And, of course, that's never going to be mentioned. I wonder if they even found something out like that, they'd even announce it. But, I mean, it's just too ironic to have that happen 2 months in a row, the exact same thing with the exact same results. It's suspicious anyhow, I would think. I mean, we're worried about people being able to hack into airplanes and take control, or hack into these self-driving cars.
Maybe I'll bring it up. I got another, Kathy, I got another call. I'll bring it up.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay.
It's Kelly.
Hi. Once you're gone, I miss the talk show, and I miss your side music there.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate
good
that.
Good luck wherever you go. I'm going to miss that show.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so I've got a text and a call about the idea that there is a possibility that the ships could have been hacked, and Kathy called up and wanted to know how is it possible we had the same exact wreck almost in the same place, and I think I was looking for an article on this. So here's an article from Mashable 2017, and this is from the 7th month, July 18, 2017. So just a month ago, the Internet of Things has shown us time and again that nothing connected to the Internet is safe from hackers, and yet we've mostly written off security camera-fueled botnets as someone else's problem. A botnet is, I won't get into it, but it is kind of a virus that is sent out by companies or individuals to do hacking. But what if the thing in question happens to be a boat loaded with weapons? A group of cybersecurity researchers is having a field day online with the discovery that the configuration of certain ship satellite antenna systems leaves them wide open to attack, and the possible consequences are startling. Anyone who's gained access to the system in question and was so inclined could manually change a ship's GPS coordinates or possibly even brick the boat's navigation system entirely by uploading new firmware. And why would anyone want to do that? ... That's pretty fascinating. All right, so March 2nd, 2016. From high seas to high tech, this is Fox. Pirates hack shipping company. Cunning tech-savvy pirates hacked a shipping company's systems, enabling them to carefully target cargo on the firm's vessels. A report released by Verizon Risk Research Investigation Solutions and Knowledge Team reveals that a global shipping conglomerate fell victim to the high-tech pirates. The unnamed company contacted the Verizon cyber specialists after the pirates adopted a new strategy. The report said, quote, rather than spending days holding boats and their crews hostage while they rummaged through the cargo, these pirates began to attack shipping vessels in an extremely targeted and timely fashion. Specifically, they would board a ship vessel, force the crew into one area, and within a short amount of time, they would depart. Hours later, the ship's crews left their safe rooms. They discovered that the pirates had targeted certain cargo containers. quote, it became apparent to the shipping company that the pirates had specific knowledge of the contents of each of the shipping crates being moved. They'd board a vessel, locate by barcode specific sought-after crates containing valuables, steal the contents of that crate in that crate only, and then depart the vessel without further incident. So, now I've got a little clip for you. And this is from today on Fox. Is someone hacking our 7th Fleet Navy to investigate after USS John S. McCain collision? Two similar collisions with shipping container vessels in 2 months in basically the same territorial waters or the same area, same part of the world.
Desperate search is underway right now in the waters off Malaysia and Singapore for sailors missing from yet another collision between a U.S. Navy warship and a civilian vessel. Now, the Navy has expanded its investigation. National Security Correspondent Jennifer Griffin has the latest tonight from the Pentagon.
It's the second major collision involving a U.S. Navy warship in the past 2 months in the Pacific. The latest collision involved the USS John S. McCain, a guided missile destroyer, which collided with a Liberian-flagged oil tanker 3 times its size near the busy Strait of Malacca. The warship was able to limp into port and is now in Singapore. 10 sailors remain missing. Diving operations to search the flooded berthing compartments began at first light. 4 injured sailors were airlifted off the ship. The Navy's top officer has called for a broader investigation.
I direct an operational pause be taken in all of our fleets around the world.
While traveling in Jordan, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said he fully supported Admiral John Richardson's efforts.
He has put together a broader inquiry to look into these incidents and to determine any of the causal factors.
This is the 4th major mishap for the U.S. Navy in the Pacific since late January. A guided missile cruiser ran aground in Tokyo Bay, spilling more than 1,000 gallons of oil. In May, another cruiser collided with a fishing boat. In June, the USS Fitzgerald hit a cargo ship, killing 7 Navy sailors. 2 ship captains have already been relieved for these prior mishaps. President Trump responded to news of the crash as he returned to the White House from vacation. He later tweeted, "Thoughts and prayers are with our U.S. Navy sailors aboard the USS John S. McCain, where search and rescue efforts are underway." The Navy is down 2 destroyers capable of shooting down ballistic missiles, both part of its defense against a potential North Korean missile strike, further straining an already stretched Navy.
The Navy is looking into how it qualifies junior officers to drive ships and how sailors are trained to stand watch, especially in these busy shipping lanes, Brett.
Jennifer Griffin, live at the Pentagon. Jennifer, thank you.
All right. So, imagine that. I mean, if they can hack into that, what else can they hack into? And I am looking for anything else that's remotely related to this story. And I'm not really seeing anything, but I have to keep my eyes peeled. All right, let's take a break for local news. Kelly O'Connell and AMLS Cruises at 7:27. We'll be right back. I have a very bizarre story for you from overseas. An inventor who had built the world's largest private submarine later sunk the submarine in an apparent attempt to cover up the murder of a journalist who was on the submarine interviewing him. Who knows what happened?
Has been found in the water of a Copenhagen suburb. Police haven't confirmed whether it's the body of missing Swedish journalist Kim Wall. The Danish inventor, charged with killing the journalist in his homemade submarine, recently changed his account to claim that she died in an accident on board and that he'd buried her at sea. Peter Madsen initially said he'd dropped her off alive in the Danish capital. Madsen's charged with the manslaughter of 30-year-old Wall, who's been missing since he took her out to sea in his 17-meter submarine on August the 10th. He denies the charge. The inventor's lawyer explained that, amongst other things, he believes that Kim Wall's relatives in particular need to know what's happened, and that's why he wanted to speak about what happened on board Nautilus. Madsen was rescued a day later after his UC-3 Nautilus sank. Police found nobody else in the wreck.
All right, so here's a little bit more on this. And this is from, I've got three or four clips, but I only want to play another one. Police find headless torso in search for journalist believed killed on submarine. So I wonder what happened what exactly it was that caused him to murder her. Oh, okay. That one is that's from the Washington Post. Here is something from Tomo News.
The suspected death of a journalist in a sunken submarine. A Danish amateur submarine and rocket builder known as Rocket Madsen has been arrested over the disappearance of a Swedish journalist who was reportedly on his submarine before it sank. Freelance journalist Kim Wall was last seen on board the UC-3 Nautilus submarine with owner Peter Madsen. The submarine left the port of Copenhagen last Thursday evening. Wall's boyfriend reported her missing early Friday morning when they didn't return, which prompted a search and rescue operation. Private motorboats later discovered the downed submarine near the Drogden Lighthouse in Kue Bay. Madsen reportedly jumped into the water and swam for safety as the submarine sank. After he was brought to shore, Madsen told police that the submarine sank due to problems with a ballast tank. He also claimed that Wall had been dropped off at the port of Copenhagen on Thursday night and hadn't been on board when the vessel sank. The crowdfunded UC-3 Nautilus is reportedly the largest private-built submarine in the world. Contrary to Madsen's claim of a technical fault, Copenhagen police said the submarine was sunk deliberately, but no body was found inside. According to Wall's Twitter biography, she lived in New York and Beijing. Her work has appeared in various publications such as The Guardian, The New York Times, and Foreign Policy magazine. Kim Wall's family said the journalist was with Madsen to conduct an interview for a story. Madsen has been charged with involuntary manslaughter, but he has denied any wrongdoing. Getting lost at sea is a nightmare.
All right, so very strange story. Wonder what happened if, I mean, it would only be speculation, but you have to, your mind kind of can't help but wonder what happened. Some more headlines for you. Tax cut odds are going up because the Republicans need some sort of an achievement, according to the story. And now here's more articles on the possible hacking into the fleet. Quake hits Italian island and buildings collapse. Baby pulled from rubble. Judge returns fire when ambushed outside of courthouse. Oversaw suspects lawsuit. That judge was the judge in the case when this guy's son, who was an athlete, was convicted of sex assault. I think that's the story. Chaos breaking out at Charlottesville City Council meeting. Meanwhile, a man tried to bomb a Confederate statue in Houston, but was not successful. Christopher Columbus Monument vandalized in Baltimore. Here's a serious question. How far are you going to take this historical purification? Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. It is said that his DNA has been matched to the descendants of a lady by the name of Sally Hemming, who was a slave. Although they're not sure if it was from Jefferson or somebody else in his family, it has been traced to his family, and it's assumed that it was Thomas Jefferson, who was a widower at the time when the shenanigans supposedly started. And there was a rumor at the time that there were some light-skinned slaves on his property. So when the two daughters of this lady ran away to the north, Jefferson made no effort to track them down. So, is that rape? It was, as far as I know, not illegal to have sex with your own slave. So it wouldn't have been legally rape, but I'm sure that anybody who heard the story and understands the idea of statutory rape or legal rape would say it's in that category. So here is a very ironic question. The guy that laid out the roadmap for freedom and liberty for countless Americans, tens of millions of Americans, and then billions of people around the world, was himself a slave owner. And it was involved in a relationship with his slave, which I guess could have been consensual, but would have been, have a lot of ethical, moral problems, needless to say. And so should this guy's monuments be taken down? Should Monticello be raised? Should the Jefferson Monument in Washington, D.C. be dismembered? I mean, that's the direction we're headed, right? So are you going to have to try to find somebody who's perfect in history to build your society on? Which I guess, you know, the claim is that we've already done that, that the culture was originally Christian and therefore it was built on the legend of the perfect Jesus. So Fox News eyeing reality series about women seeking sperm donors. Think about all of the women that don't want a man in their life. Black caucus discussing impeachment of the president, and Paul Manafort is being put under pressure to crack, and they're starting to suspect him of money laundering, which they had already looked into Paul Manafort some years ago on the same topic. Tiger Woods has his attorney sent a threatening letter to a website that published naked pictures of him and one of his many girlfriends. All right, so let's take a little break here and be right back. 523, got your weather for you. AM Lushkers is AM 1450. 805-6180 is your text line. And 523-1450, call in.
As we kiss goodbye and part, I knew we'd never meet again.
All right, so George Washington was the largest landowner in Virginia, and I think that that guy had a lot of slaves too. So 523-1450, if you go in the direction that Black Lives Matter and Antifa are heading and all of the other protest groups, the race identity people, what is going to be the end game? What's going to be the outcome? Are you going to... I was thinking about this last night. If you really took it to its logical conclusion, you would tear up the Constitution, be in the Declaration, because these were put together by racists, by the founders, slave owners. You know, some of the people were not crazy about slavery. I don't think Patrick Henry was, but I'll have to do, as memory serves, I'll have to go back and look into him. But the party is now being painted as a racist party. Now, Howard Dean, who's one of the most irresponsible people I've ever seen in terms of making wild statements about other people, he ran for president, and the scream that went around the world, I'm sure you remember that, says if you vote Republican in 2018, you're voting for racism. So is the GOP going to fight back against the claim? And I've got another clip from Rush Limbaugh that deals with this that I think is, you know, the GOP is refusing to stand up and fight back against the media. And so the media is just tearing the party to shreds.
You know, a lot of people have been praising Mitt Romney for coming out with this forceful statement on Facebook against Donald Trump. But I have to recall that
MSNBC, Howard Dean, who will say anything that whoever, I guess, sets him up to do these things, is a governor of Vermont, he will say anything that's needed to be said. And so for him to show up and say that the GOP is racist is just part and parcel of his thing.
Donald Trump had already gone after Muslims, called Mexicans rapists, gone after women, gone after former Miss Universe contestants, you name it. You know, he had offended everyone. When Mitt Romney went and begged for a job at a dinner in November of 2016, I mean, Donald Trump had already been doing that. The Access Hollywood video had happened, and Mitt Romney was perfectly happy to sit down with him and eat dinner. Do you think Republicans are getting praise, undeserved praise, for only being willing to name Donald Trump and stand up to him when it's actual Nazis that he is excusing?
Well, we don't know what went on at that dinner, but I think Mitt Romney came out of that dinner looking pretty terrible. And I think the lesson is don't meet with Donald Trump if you don't want somewhere down the line, you don't want to look pretty bad. This guy is a guy who has no moral character. But the interesting thing about this, Joy, is I think this may be the moment for Trump that last weekend. I think today in the 2018 elections, if you vote for a Republican, you're supporting Donald Trump. This has now become a referendum. If you want to vote for a racist in the White House, then you better vote for Republicans. But if you want to vote for the Democrats and really have change, that's where I think America is going. And I think there's a lot more decent.
What change does the Democratic Party offer except more big government, higher taxes, more regulation, smaller economy, race, identity, politics?
Decent Americans, and there are the kind of people who supported the folks in Charlottesville, and Trump is in the minority, and that's what the polling shows. So I think this may be the moment that turns America away from the Republican Party, which, frankly, long before Donald Trump was dog whistling race, gay rights, immigrants, and Muslims.
I mean, what is the Democratic Party run off of except racism? They claim to be anti-racists, right? So everybody else is a racist. And they run off of all of these other crazy things that he just mentioned. They make a cult out of the gay movement and gay marriage. They do all of this crazy stuff that's destroying the country in terms of being able to have a center anymore, and then they blame it on Trump. Here is Rush explaining why GOP is letting leftist media tear the country apart.
The media is dividing this country and tearing it apart. And because of fear of the media, way too many on our side are unwilling to stop or even try to stop or oppose this. Identity politics, which we have been focusing on in recent weeks, intensely in recent days, is the primary weapon being used to divide the country. Nothing new about it, but it is reaching new heights. And what is going on is so far from reality that it's tough to actually make sense of it. I mean, here's one way of looking at this. No, I'm going to answer the agenda question. I give people time to think about it, Snurdly. So I ask an intriguing question. Everybody wants the answer. Well, coming back to it, you could, if you were brave and courageous, you could say this. Black people and white people who were never slaves are fighting white people and others who were never Nazis over Confederate statues erected by Democrats, and somehow it's all Donald Trump's fault. That would be one brief summary. Now, that summary, if uttered, say, to a CNN info babe, would be met with a meltdown. I watched a meltdown today. You know what happens? You know what CNN is? CNN goes out and they find some sucker Republican to accept an invitation to appear. The sucker Republican shows up and here's the interview. Do you condemn the white racists? Yeah, I do. But I also condemn the violence on the... Do you think there's violence on the left? You're a racist. Do you think there's violence on the left? You're a pig. Do you condemn the white nationalists? Do you condemn the... Yeah, I condemn it all. I condemn violence by everybody committing it, including the Antifa. Do you think there's violence on the left? That's outrageous. That's racist. Do you condemn? Do you? That's what it's become, folks. Do you condemn? Will you condemn?
And we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is O.
What's up, O?
Doing, man. You know, I was just calling to talk about, you know, all the statues that are being taken down. And that's all history. Why take history down when that's what made America?
Because they say it's racist history.
It's not racist, man. It's our founding fathers. You know, it's just, I'm Mexican. And it really bugs me for these statues to be coming down. You know, and I don't see why it should make a point of racism when it's not really a racism. It's to stand at a point from our history that they did something for our nation.
So what should they do with all the people that are complaining?
Put it to a vote like we do everything else. Not everybody's complaining.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a select few.
Very true. Good point. So thanks for the call. All right. So, what do you think should be done? I mean, it's an issue that has come up through the media, and so the media sets the agenda for everybody, and then you have to respond to that. We have another call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Mark.
Hey, Mark, what's up? What's on your mind?
Well, in 1936, when they dedicated the Robert E. Lee Monument in Dallas, FDR was present there, who... I don't believe he's a right-wing extremist, but I am very happy to be here in the unveiling of the statue of General Robert E. Lee. All over the U.S., we recognize his great leadership of men as well as a great general. But also, all over the U.S., I believe that we recognize something much more important. We recognize him as one of the great American Christians, and one of our great American gentlemen. And, you know, what do pro-abortion people tell everybody that is against abortion? Well, don't have one. Well, if these people are offended by monuments, don't go visit them.
Right.
It's an option.
Yeah, that's good.
And I question whether the NAACP and these other black activists are helping their people by this anti-Confederacy movement as much as somebody like Ben and Candy Carson, who have a foundation that gives scholarships in all 50 states to underprivileged kids, I believe underprivileged kids, that excel in academia and also community.
Uh-huh. All right, good points, Mark. Thanks for the call. All right, folks. So that's assuming that these people care about the black people. I mean, it's my impression that blacks are something to get ahead, that you complain about how black people are treated because you want to attack the people that you say are mistreating them. I mean, the statues were there minding their business. I hadn't heard anything about them. I mean, there was a big deal about the Confederate flag. And then that was taken down. And I guess the next obvious target is the statues. But, I mean, the upshot is that these statues are not keeping black people from achievement. You can say that they're racist, although the statues themselves are obviously not racist. It's the people who are in the statues that are depicted by the statues that are supposed to be racist, but or were racist. But, you know, it was my understanding that there was there's this idea that we would, after the Civil War, we would come back together and kind of heal the wounds of the nation, and we would rebuild the South. And then, you know, what happened, Abraham Lincoln had all these ideas. He was assassinated. The person who took over for him was a person who was not a Republican. He was a Democrat. So ironically enough, the president was a Republican. The vice president was a Democrat. And, you know, now this guy is, he's on the $20 bill, but he was really, according to some of the stuff that I've read, Andrew Jackson was supposed to be a racist. And so the fight against black people, what has been almost universally in the history of America, been a democratic undertaking. So, I mean, I don't know what you can say about that, but I mean, if the Democrats are pro-black, it's a very recent development. And I think that they're still using them. They're using the race card to try to get themselves ahead. Now, here's Rush Limbaugh. We may be on the verge of a second civil war.
All of this is about getting rid of Trump. And it just means they've got nothing on Russia. It means, which we've known. But now they are illustrating that to us. Come on, Wolf, do you really not know this is an ISIS technique? And do you really not know that what happened in Charlotte, really, really, when you get down to it, you've got to ask, where were the cops? Why did the cops stand down? It was plain as day that violence was going to happen because that's what Antifa does. Antifa is rioters. And with no effort to separate Antifa from these other goons on the right, it was a recipe that was infinitely predictable. Somebody wanted it to happen. And do you not get the impression that the media is excited and thrilled about this?
Obviously, whoever was in charge of not sending the police in, who I assume was Terry McAuliffe, who's a very, very close friend of the Clintons and was a money raiser for Bill Clinton, who, if there is a fight between Black Lives Matter or Antifa and the white supremacists, who wins? Because they're on the right side of history, right? The Antifa does. So who gains from a fight between these neo-Nazis and Antifa? The Democratic Party does. And McAuliffe is planning on running for office. Now, the Pope, switching gears here, writes of the migrant, writes, according to the Pope, that the Pope is saying that migrants have a right over national security concerns. In other words, take these people in regardless of the consequences or the risks. Now, this is the Pope. Let me ask you this. How many